I'd walked to the hospital, and I walked back, cutting a diagonal across the grounds, then going into some woods. I climbed a tall, forbidding fence at the end of the woods, darted and stalked across the Long Island Expressway, made private discoveries in the face of speeding headlights. Back at the motel, I drew myself a steamy hot bath. I climbed in, and things slowly began to come back into perspective. I remembered another mad scene I'd witnessed. It was in a snooker hall and gin mill in Frankfort, Kentucky. At that time, in 62, I think, I was carrying a small pistol myself, so I was no great judge of madness. What happened was this. A scarecrow-looking farm boy in the bar had decided he was going to sneak a dance with this other boy's girl. They started dancing to this slow Elvis Presley song that was popular back then. One Night, I think it was. And when the other boy saw what was happening, he walked up to the dancing couple, spit in the scarecrow's face, and then stabbed him in the crotch area. Just that quick. Everybody in the bar immediately crowded around the crumpled clothes and body on the dance floor, and with hot eyes and crying and low whispers, they kept repeating around the circle that old Bean had been stabbed. If you had taken that word's meaning from its tone, you'd have guessed that the pleasures of dance and whiskey had been too much for Bean and that he'd passed out. Pistol on and all, I'd nearly thrown up on the spot. The news about the Harley Wynn photograph came while I was up to my neck in hot bathwater and suds. I was reading single pages out of Jeb Magruder's book on his life in Watergate, then putting it to rest on the lip of the tub. I found it infuriating that he'd had the cunning to churn out the book so quickly. The news came when I was melancholy, sentimental as country music, missing Nan and Cat and Janie Bug like close friends moved out of town. It couldn't have come at a better time if I'd been in charge of planning my own life. The phone rang in the bedroom, and I just let it ring. I thought it was Asher or that nurse checking on me. It kept right on ringing, a little red light buzzing with it. "Terrell," I heard when I finally picked it up. "That shit-heel cocksucker Terrell." The distant voice on the phone was Lewis Roston's. It wasn't Roston's normal speaking voice, though. Roston was rarely, if ever, vulgar. I tried to knock a cigarette out of a pack, and four or five tumbled out. "What about Terrell?"
"Harley Wynn is Terrell's man. He's his lawyer. He's from Houston is the reason nobody knew him."
Roston had started to shout. He was very happy. I was nervously lighting up one of the cigarettes.
"You did it this time, you smart bastard," I heard. "Reed says he could and will kiss your ass on television, your sweet ass."
Somebody else was on the line. Happy Rebel Yells was who it was. I was holding the receiver away from my ear, starting to giggle like the big fucking village idiot. More people came on the line with congratulations. "How did it break?" I kept asking each new voice. "How did it break?"
"Complicated,"
I eventually got Lewis back.
"Some friend of Reed's is from Houston. Who cares?"
I was just beginning to figure out the ramifications, and I couldn't believe it. It seemed so perfectly right and logical. John Boy Terrell.
"Let me have some damn enthusiasm,"
quiet little Roston yelled over the phone. I obliged him. I went partially, happily berserk at Hojo's in West Hampton, Long Island. I gave out some rebel hoots and howls that had people knocking at me through the motel walls. I crow-hopped around the rug on my big bare feet. I kicked the walls like somebody on their way home from singing in the rain. Before I go any farther, though, I should tell you that during the years 1958 to 1962, Terrell was governor of the state. That from about 1958 on, Terrell had just about run Tennessee, and that some people, myself included, thought that he had run it very, very badly. What's more, Terrell certainly had a major grudge to settle with Jimmy Horn. That night, my batteries all recharged, I wrote up a long, inspired list of follow-up calls and visits I still had to make in the North. For the very first time, I felt totally comfortable with the story. I prepared for a trip out to Berryman's summer house in a place called Hampton Bays. It was there that I was to make my one big mistake in judgment while recording this story.